happily in the Chautauqua fashion, we've finished the announcements. Which leads me to our speaker of this noon. Rabbi Roger Klein is a rabbi at the Temple Tiferet Israel in Cleveland, Ohio. He's a graduate of the Hebrew Union College Institute of Jewish Religion, where he earned a Master of Hebrew Letters degree. He also holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Chicago. He continued his studies at the University of Tübingen in Germany, and as well as at the Pardes Institute in Jerusalem. He has served as congregational rabbis in Indiana and Columbus, Ohio, before coming to Cleveland. He's taught at the University of Kentucky, Wesleyan University in Connecticut, Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, and also at the Cleveland College of Judaic Studies in Cleveland. He has lectured extensively on Jewish thought and philosophy. Now, one of the aspects of him that isn't in his bio is that he's an expert on music, and often gives the pre-concert lectures at the Cleveland Orchestra. So he's really an all-around guy. And by the way, when the Indians were having trouble with their pitching, as they've had most of the time, a number of years ago, he reminded me that he had pitched for his high school and I think his college team, and said, "How far down the list can I be?" So... Anyway, without further ado, it's my privilege and our privilege to present Rabbi Roger Klein.
That's so nice, Fred. Thanks a lot. Thanks so very much. It's so nice to be here again with you. Apropos of the Indians' pitching woes, when I called my brother once when the Indians were going through 40 pitchers by mid-season, and I said to my brother, "How far down the list could I be?" I thought I had to be in the top 150 in northern Ohio. So I got my glove out, my glovolium, and I was working and putting under my mattress. And my brother said to me, "You're not even in the top 50,000. So, and I haven't talked to him since. So glad that you're here. Those of you who were here yesterday know that I gave a presentation on Jewish humor. And one of the advantages to a person talking about a subject like this is the aftermath of the talk is as exciting, if not more exciting, than the talk itself for the presenter. Because in the meantime, I have been regaled with all kinds of jokes from people who wanted to be sure I knew this one and I knew that one and so on. So I keep learning on that subject, which is a pleasure for me. Well, I know that we have until about 1:15, I believe. Those of you who need to get up and leave a little bit early, don't worry about it at all. Just get up and leave. I know you've got a lot of things to do. But I'll try to end completely by 1:15. I think of what we're going to do this afternoon as a kind of presentation discussion. You, I hope, have some materials in your hands, or at least can see one in the hands of the person next to you. And I want to do some Bible reading with you, and this will mean some interaction and some discussion along the way. So my plan is not to just talk straight for X minutes and then whatever is left leave for discussion, although I definitely will leave time for a question period. But if along the way you have an insight about what we're reading or a question, don't hesitate to raise your hand to do it. Now, I know this can lead to some chaos, so if you'll allow me the following kind of prerogative. I want some discussion along the way, but if I feel that we're not moving quickly enough through what I want to present, if you'll allow me to say, good question, can we hold it until later or until another time? So please don't be insulted if I cut the question for a while as we're moving on, because I do want to try to present something of a narrative line to you this afternoon. So the title of this presentation is Biblical Women, with a subtitle, Scripture's Great Revolutionary Counter-Narrative. So what I want to do is focus on some very significant biblical women and see what role they're playing in the Bible, because I want to make a kind of claim here that though there is a what we might call surface narrative of Scripture, that the Bible is also, and not only in this way, presenting counter-narratives, narratives that are a bit more under the surface, which are in conversation with the central narrative, often opposing it. Now, I want to quote from a very interesting commentary on the book of Joshua by an author whose name is L. Daniel Hawk. Here's what Hawk says. The book's focus, he's talking about the book of Joshua, but I want to generalize it. The book's focus on themes of land, religion, and ethnic separation, and the conflicted presentation of these themes reveals a struggle to comprehend the meaning of Israel's past, and particularly as it addressed the nation's self-understanding as a people of God. What I want to emphasize here is the struggle to comprehend the message. The Bible is in conversation with itself, or in my language, narrative and counter-narrative. Joshua, Hawk goes on to say, is concerned not only with preserving stories about Israel's occupation of the land, but also in a more profound sense with coming to terms with these stories. Let me just briefly tell you what Hawk is doing with the book of Joshua. If you read the book of Joshua, it looks like, from beginning to end, a narrative about conquest and about displacement of the people, even about extermination, underwritten by God. This narrative, normative narrative, because it's underwritten by God and by the book of Deuteronomy, is contrasted with a counter-narrative. This program is never completed. The Israelites make covenants with the peoples of the land. We find with the distribution of the land in the middle of the book that peoples remain there. And so the book of Joshua is engaged in a conversation about the advisability, the wisdom of its main narrative line. This undermining of the main narrative line happens right at the beginning of the book of Joshua with a remarkable woman, a Canaanite woman, Rahab, who is a harlot. And when Joshua sends spies to reconnoiter the land and to find out what is facing the people when they cross the Jordan and begin their conquest, they meet up with Rahab, who is willing to support them and to hide them. And why is she willing to do so? Well, she responds by giving the most cogent and persuasive narrative of Israel's saving history of anyone in the Bible. She understands the God who saves and redeems. What does this mean? Even before the Israelites get into Canaan and begin the process of conquest and displacement, that narrative is already undermined by the story of Rahab, a Canaanite who is not faceless and merely an enemy, but an individual a character with whom we and the biblical author identifies from the start. So that the whole narrative of conquest is challenged within that narrative itself. And that's the theme I want to try to pursue here this afternoon in terms of biblical women. Now, what's the main narrative? Well, there are many ways of describing it. But in terms of our subject for this afternoon, let me suggest that the main narrative has a patriarchal framework. It's about and features social hierarchy with men at the top. God speaks mostly to men. There are a couple of exceptions. He speaks to Eve. He speaks to Rebekah. But it's mainly with men with whom he speaks and with whom he consummates the covenant. The priesthood is populated by men only. Men control the sanctuary, the ritual objects, and the main purpose of the ritual. And that is to construct and maintain intimacy with God. Men are in charge of that. The covenant is made only with men. The Torah, from time to time, talks about the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which, as you know, in Reformed prayer books, was the way in which we introduce the Amida, the Avot, the Elohei Abraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov, and so on. Now we've added the matriarchs. But throughout most of biblical history, not Jewish history, it's the men who trace the main elements of the historical line. The tribes are headed by men only, the 12 sons of Jacob. Every king of ancient Israel, north and south, with one very minor exception, is a man. Most of the prophets, all of the written, the literary prophets, prophets for whom a book is named, are men. There happen to be four women prophets, preeminently Miriam, Moses' sister, and Deborah. We have Huldah, who plays a fairly significant though limited role, and then we have some minor, very minor person in the book of Nehemiah. Priests, prophets, kings, patriarchs, covenant are all consummated with men. A woman's vow is not valid unless it is underwritten by a man. A woman's oath requires male support. And one could go on with this. The surface framework, social framework, is determinedly patriarchal. What I want to suggest is that we have a counter-narrative featuring important women who, in some sense, challenge this main narrative, and in doing so, tell us something about the Bible's aspirations. Now, let's talk a little bit about aspirations for a moment. God freed the Israelites from Egypt. Let's call that negative freedom, freedom from bondage, which is incomplete without positive freedom. Freedom to construct our lives on our own values and our own terms. So the splitting of the Red Sea is not complete until Mount Sinai. That whole narrative is about freedom. Then we get the Ten Commandments, which features freedom. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and so on. The Shabbat commandment. You shall allow everybody, including your slaves, to rest on Shabbat. That's in chapter 20 of Exodus. Chapter 21 begins a small law code, the so-called Book of the Covenant. What's the first topic that is taken up in chapter 21 of Exodus? Slavery. Why? After the whole first half of the book of Exodus has been concerned with freedom, and the Ten Commandments feature among its primary motifs freedom, does the Torah then turn to slavery? The answer is, an answer, is that the Bible's aspirations meet up against reality. And whenever one is trying to pursue aspirations, there are at least two ways of doing it: evolutionarily and revolutionarily. The Bible could have said, we now stand for freedom, no more slavery, we abandon it right now. But that would turn the society upside down and perhaps cause a counter-revolution, which of course happened, for example, in the French Revolution. Going too fast sometimes defeats itself. So the Bible is both idealistic in terms of aspiration and realistic in terms of how much can be accomplished in a short period of time. And so the Bible assumes slavery, but transforms it in significant ways even at the beginning. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator and so on. The preamble right to the Declaration of Independence. But it wasn't until when, at least the 14th Amendment, post-Civil War amendment, that this idea of equality of all people, equal protection under the law, due process of the law for everybody, including newly freed slaves. It wasn't until after the Civil War that the aspiration of the Declaration of Independence was to some significant degree realized. And the 14th Amendment, if I'm not mistaken, served as the foundation for the turning back of Plessy versus Ferguson, which promoted separate but equal schools, which itself was overturned by Brown versus Board of Education. So that aspirations can be enunciated early without their being fully actualized or realized until much later. But the aspiration drives the process. A central aspiration of the Bible, especially the book of Exodus, is freedom, liberation of everybody. But this comes gradually, and I want to try to explore this now in our reading of our materials. So you have your materials here. Let's turn to page 3. They're not numbered. Turn to the third page, and you have 38. That's chapter 38 of the book of Genesis. I want to look at three different units. I want to look at the Tamar in chapter 30 of Genesis. Then I want to look at the daughters of Tselophehad in chapter 27 of the book of Numbers. And I hope if you go away with nothing else after this talk, it would be great if everybody would use the word Tselophehad in a sentence to somebody else before the day is over. Wouldn't it be great if your friends could know that you know about the daughters of Tselophehad? We want to talk about them. And we also want to talk about five women at the beginning of the book of Exodus, and then to close with the book of Ruth. Let's see what we can do here. Chapter 38. Now remember who Judah is. Judah is one of the sons of Jacob, one of the 12 sons of Jacob. In chapter 37, we have this whole conflict between Joseph and his brothers. They put him in a pit and finally sell him to Midianite or Ishmaelite traders, and he's now on his way to Egypt, at which point the story is interrupted. Who is Judah? Judah is the ancestor of the tribe of Judah, which, after the Babylonian exile, hundreds of years later, becomes the only remaining tribe of this people. They alone, the tribe of Judah, return to Canaan, become Yehudim, become Jews. Judah is also the ancestor of the tribe that gives us King David. And by extension, gives us the Messiah of Jewish expectation. So Judah is not only an important individual, but he plays an important structural function in the history, the subsequent history, which continues to our own day because the Messiah has not come yet, in Jewish history. So Judah is a very important figure. About the time Judah left his brothers and camped near a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira, there Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shuah, and he married her and cohabited with her. She conceived and bore a son and named him Er. She conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. Once again she bore a son and named him Shelah. He was at Chaziv when she bore him. Judah got a wife for Er, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. She's a Canaanite. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was displeasing to the Lord, and the Lord took his life. Why? What did Er do to displease God? The author doesn't tell us, and the author doesn't care. The subsequent Midrash may care and raise questions and maybe come up with the tantalizing answers. The reason the author doesn't care, not that I know this from the author himself, is that the author has one particular narrative line to pursue, and he's not going to be detained by digressions. There's no such thing inherently as a digression. A digression is only a digression if you've got a main narrative line. And the author has asserted, implicitly so far, what it is. But Er, verse 7, Judah's firstborn, was displeasing to the Lord, and the Lord took his life. Wow. That raises a question the author's not interested in either. Then Judah said to Onan, "Join with your brother's wife and do your duty by her as a brother-in-law." This story already presumes the idea of levirate marriage, which goes something like this. If a married man, dies before giving birth to a son, that man's brother has the obligation to cohabit with the widow in order to raise up a son in the name of his brother, who will then carry on the property line and the name of the person. One can imagine how problematic an idea levirate marriage is. What does the wife of the brother-in-law think about all of this, for example? All right, but it's presumed as a duty. Join with your brother's wife and do your duty, brother, and provide offspring for your brother. But Onan, knowing that the seed would not count as his, let it go to waste, literally spilled his seed on the ground, Onanism. Whenever he joined with his brother's wife, so as not to provide offspring for his brother. In other words, Judah has himself married a Canaanite woman and married his son to a Canaanite woman, and the son dies, and the son's brother will not do his duty. This is an Israelite who refuses to do his duty. Verse 10. What he did was displeasing to the Lord, and he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Stay as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, he too might die like his brothers. Namely, "Ooh, this may be a very dangerous woman. I had better keep my third and only remaining son from her." The implication is, though it's not asserted, is he never intends to give Shelah to her at all. But there's an obligation that has not been discharged yet. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. A long time afterward, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. When his period of mourning was over, Judah went up to Timnah to his sheep shears, together with his friend Hira the Adullamite. And Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah for the sheep shearing." Now, why does the author tell us that Judah's wife has died? Because now Judah is in a state of sexual neediness. And let me put it this way theologically. God is using the unmet primal physical drives of human beings to achieve his purposes. This is an affirmation of the material world and of the drives which can get us into trouble, but which also can serve higher purposes. Okay? Now, so this makes Judah vulnerable to the blandishments of, say, an attractive woman. Verse 13, "And Tamar was told, 'Your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah for the sheep shearing.' So she took off her widow's garb, covered her face with a veil, wrapping herself up, sat down at the entrance to Enayim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him as a wife." Okay? There's an obligation that needs to be discharged. Onan didn't do it. Judah didn't do it. Shelah didn't do it. Somebody's got to discharge this obligation. Tamar, who doesn't have this obligation, is about to discharge it. When Judah saw her, verse 15, he took her for a harlot, for she had covered her face. She's doing something quite dangerous to her. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here, let me sleep with you." For he didn't know that she was his daughter-in-law. What, she asked, "will you pay for sleeping with me?" Ah, she's a harlot and just looking for gain. He replied, "I'll send a kid from my flock." You know. But she said, "You must leave a pledge with until you have sent it. That goat is not enough for her." And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she replied, "Your seal and your cord and the staff which you carry." So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she conceived by him. Then she went on her way. She took off her veil and again put on her widow's garb. Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to redeem the pledge from the woman, but he couldn't find her. He inquired of the people of that town, "Where's the cult prostitute? The one at Enayim by the road." They said, "There's been no prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I couldn't find her." Moreover, the townspeople said, "There's been no prostitute here." Judah said, "Let her keep them then, the things I gave her, lest we become a laughing stock. I sent her this kid, but you didn't find her." End of story for Judah. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. In fact, she is with child by harlotry." That's a capital crime. "Bring her out," said Judah, "and let her be burned." As she was being brought out, she sent this message to her father-in-law: "I'm with child by the man to whom these belong." That's why she wasn't satisfied with the goat. She wanted his signature. She wanted his seal. Notice she does this in a very sensitive and adroit way. She doesn't expose him in public. She sends him a message. She's not looking for revenge or retribution. She's looking for a solution to the problem. And she added, "Examine these. Whose seal and cord and staff are these?" Judah recognized them and said, "She is more right than I am, inasmuch as I didn't give to her my son Shelah, and he was not intimate with her again." She is more right. The word the Torah used for right is tzadka. It's the verb, from which we get the word tzedaka. As you know, tzedaka does not mean charity in Judaism. It means righteousness. It doesn't mean I think I'll be a good guy and I'll give some money to those less fortunate than I am. It means a recognition of just claims. Everybody born, made in the image of God deserves to live a decent life. And those of us who have surplus have the obligation to give them from our surplus. What Tamar has done is the right thing. Tzedakah is the recognition of an inherent connection. God is called tzedakah when God is faithful to the covenant. Judah recognizes an obligation and discharges it. Tamar. And Judah recognizes that this is the case. She has made it possible for Judah's line to go on, and not the vaunted Judah, who will become the ancestor of King David and of the Messiah. Let's go on just for a bit. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. While she was in labor, one of them put out his hand. The midwife tied a crimson thread on that hand to signify this one came out first. But just then he drew back his hand. Out came his brother, and he said, this is the Isaac-Jacob story again, struggling in the womb, so to speak. And what a breach you have made for yourself. So she named him Peretz. That's what I want you to remember, the name Peretz. And afterward, his brother came out. I saw a question, a hand.
How would she have sent the message, the staff and the seal belong to the person?
I don't know. She might have said, I have your signature. I can identify you unambiguously. I would imagine. I would imagine, yeah. I don't know that, yeah.
Didn't Judah have the option of throwing the shoe down?
Okay, so, right, so this is the question. When we get to the levirate marriage idea is mentioned three times in the Tanakh, in the Bible. In this story, in Deuteronomy chapter 25, which gives the legal aspect of it, and in the book of Ruth, which we're going to look at briefly in a few minutes. They're different. In Deuteronomy 25, there is, and in Ruth, as a matter of fact, there is a way of getting out of your obligation by taking off the shoe, spitting in your face, and saying to this person, this is what we will think of the person who fails to build up his people. But that doesn't seem to be an element here. That doesn't seem to be an escape clause, which in the hand of scholars seems to mean that there is a kind of history to this idea of levirate marriage. Here we're dealing with a very primitive illustration of it, at which point an escape clause was not yet devised. It's a very good question. Okay, so now I want to move to our next person, next page. You see a 27. This is Numbers chapter 27. Do you see preliminarily, though, that Tamar represents what I'm calling this counter-narrative of women who take matters into their own hands when the men seem hapless and promote the overall aspirations of the Israelites? Chapter 27 of Numbers. The daughters, here we are in the wilderness period, near the end of the wilderness period, when the issue of the distribution of the land among the tribes is becoming thematized. Chapter 27. The daughters of Tzelophehad, of the Manassite family, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilead, Machir, the son of Manasseh, the son of Joseph tribe, came forward. The names of the daughters were Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses, Eleazar the priest, the chieftains and the whole assembly at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and they said, now imagine, it's like somebody off the street being told, you're now going to appear before the President of the United States, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and the Commissioner of Baseball. And you're trembling a little bit. And here are the daughters of Tzelophehad facing the Gedolei HaDor, the great ones of the generation, Moses and Eleazar and the whole assembly and the chieftains of the... And they said, our father died in the wilderness. He was not of the faction, of Korach's faction, which banded together against the Lord, but he died for his own sin. And he left no sons. Let not our father's name be lost to his clan, just because he had no son. Give us a holding among our father's kinsmen. So the idea is that inheritance goes through the male line. And up to this point, nobody had asked the question, what if there are no sons? And the daughters of Tzelophehad are presenting this problem Verse 5. Moses brought their case before the Lord. Here's my footnote on this verse. They came before Moses, and Moses said, you know what? I don't have a clue. I have no idea what to do about this. Excellent question. Let's see if God has an answer. And the Lord said to Moses, verse 6, the plea of Zelophehad's daughters is just. You should give them a hereditary holding among their father's kinsmen. Transfer their father's share to them. Here's my somewhat tongue-in-cheek interpretation on that line. God says, my gosh, I forgot to deal with that issue. They really do have a point. Let's decide in their favor because they've got a righteous claim. They teach God something about how to extend this notion of heredity. Verse 8. Further, speak to the Israelite people as follows. If a man dies without leaving a son, you shall transfer his property to his daughter. See, not just they're right in this case. They're right that this ought to be a law. Let's generalize this and make it permanent among the Israelites. Verse 9. If he has no daughter, you shall assign his property to his brothers. If he has no brothers, you shall assign his property to his father's brethren. If he has no brothers, and so on and so on. This shall be the law of procedure for the Israelites in accordance with the Lord's command to Moses. Well, they're right, give them their inheritance. Let's make it a law. Now that we're going to make it a law, maybe we ought to think the matter through even further. What if he doesn't have any daughters? So the daughters of Zelophehad have got God to be thinking about the ramifications of their just claim, which now becomes a law for the Israelites. And now here's a little piece of biblical humor, if you'll allow my speculation about it, in accordance with the Lord's command to Moses. Who gets credit for this law? God. They're right. Now let's make it a law of in accordance with God's word, which he gave to Moses. One might imagine that this is, in a way, a backstory of lots of Torah laws. Because so often the laws are promulgated in God's name. Thus says the Lord. But maybe more things like this happen. Somebody brought a case to God that he had not thought of. God makes a decision about it and then promulgates it in his own name. It does raise an interesting question about the processes by which law comes to be established in ancient Israel, and not only in ancient Israel. The daughters of Zelophehad, who themselves, in spite of the fact that the main men of the era, Moses, the chief priest Eleazar, the notables, the elders, God, have not thought about this or its implications. Turn the page to Exodus chapter 1. I want to just read quickly this very familiar story and note something quite remarkable here. I see a hand in the back. You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I think there is. Pardon me?
We should ask God.
We should ask God. Yeah. I don't know. There may be something about it in the legislation of the Bible, but I just don't know. These are the names. Please, question.
I noticed the name Noah is spelled N-O-A-H. I have a granddaughter,
N-O-A. Yeah. All right. So let me just see what it looks like here in chapter 27. Yeah, Noah has become a feminine name. You know, in Hebrew, Noah, the male, is Noach. Noach. I don't think Noah ends with a chet. I think the woman's name. Am I right or wrong? I'm right. So they're spelled differently in Hebrew. And let's just see, just for the sake of it, Noah. Noah's name here is not Noach. In Hebrew, Noah, the man, is Nun Chet. Noah here is Nun Ayin Hey. Noah. So they look the same, but they're different. Which is feminine. The ah, mora, and not more. More is masculine teacher.
So they were really way ahead
of their time. There you go. They were way ahead of their time. So I'm suggesting here, with too little evidence, that there is a counter narrative, and ahead of their time may be a way of saying it. Please.
I might be wrong, but it seems to be in my brain somewhere they held a portion of the land of their fathers until they married.
I don't know about that. Is that true? Is that so? What are you saying? Say it again. I don't understand. I'm sure I understood. So they inherited from their father. Oh, I see. Okay. Is that biblical, you think, or post-biblical? You think it's biblical? Okay. 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 When somebody finds out the answer to this, call Jerry. And Jerry will pass it on to me. I'm kidding a little bit. Not much. You can Google it. Should we do it now? No. Exodus chapter 1. Yeah, Google knows all the answers. Okay, so these are the names of the sons of Israel who came out of Egypt with Jacob. And there they are. Verse 6. Joseph died all his brothers, but the Israelites were fertile and prolific. They multiplied and increased very greatly, so the land was filled with them. A new king arose over Egypt who didn't know Joseph, and he said to his people, "Look, the Israelites are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so they don't increase," and so on. So verse 11, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built garrison cities for Pharaoh, verse 12. But the more they were oppressed, the more they increased. In other words, genocide instrument number one fails. Verse 13. The Egyptians ruthlessly imposed upon the Israelites the various labors that they made them perform. Ruthlessly they made their lives bitter with harsh labor. Verse 15. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. Now, this is a bit of a puzzle. The Hebrew for Hebrew midwives can be understood in two ways. The midwives who were Hebrews, or the midwives who were Egyptians who served as midwives to the Hebrews. The Hebrew is ambiguous. And the commentators down through the ages are divided about which to choose. I'm going to choose that they are Egyptians, okay? So it's not certain that that's right, but it's plausible, and it's supported by some commentators. The king of Egypt spoke to the Egyptian midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, saying, "When you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live." The midwives, fearing God, Yirat Hashem, fearing God, did not do as the king of Egypt had told them, so they let the boys live. What does fearing God mean? Well, one suggestion is that, and this is a suggestion from Nachum Sarna, one of the great Bible scholars of our era of blessed memory, says that it means following the dictates of your conscience. The Egyptians have not heard anything from the God of Israel. Therefore, they're not being faithful to God. They're not being faithful to what we might call stipulated law. They're being faithful to what we might call natural law, that to which our conscience prompts us. And so these Egyptian women are seen here by the biblical author as great heroes, because they resist, in an act of of courageous civil disobedience, the command of the Pharaoh, because they insist on doing the right thing, even at peril to themselves. So, verse 18, the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing, letting the Hebrew boys live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They're vigorous. Before the midwife can come to them, they have given birth." Not only do they do the right thing in the face of Pharaoh's command, but they're able to describe what they have done in order to dissemble and to make Pharaoh think that really we had no choice, where in fact it was a choice. So not only are they moral, but they're extraordinarily clever in the face of a threat. Verse 20, "And God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and increased. And because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh charged his people, saying, 'Every boy that is born you shall throw into the Nile, but let every girl live.' A certain man of the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw how beautiful he was, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a wicker basket for him, caulked it with bitumen and pitch, put the child in it, placed it among the reeds at the bank of the Nile, and his sister stationed herself at a distance to learn what would befall him." This is our third and fourth women in this story. We have the two midwives, now we have the sister and the mother of Moses. The daughter of Pharaoh, this is our fifth woman. In the space of one chapter and 5 verses, 5 significant women are introduced to us. We've already seen the decisive role played by the midwives. Now, Moses' mother does something to save his life and then sends his sister out to keep tabs on what is happening. The daughter of Pharaoh, now it goes without saying, the daughter of Pharaoh comes from the very center of the tyranny and the oppression. She has dinner with the Pharaoh. And therefore, she is conversant, if not potentially complicitous, in this persecution of the Israelites. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the Nile while her maidens walked along the Nile. She spied the basket among the reeds, sent her slave girl to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw that it was a child, a boy crying. She took pity on it and said, "This must be a Hebrew child." Now, the phrase, "she took pity on it," I think is one of the most remarkable sentences in the entire Bible. Here is this woman from the center of tyranny, in a way a representative in this story of Pharaoh himself, who is humanized by the biblical author as being able to feel sympathy and to express pity for someone else, but especially someone else whom she identifies as the enemy. She transcends parochial boundaries and expresses a deeply human sentiment. It's one of the reasons, it seems to me, that the biblical author says she saw a child, a boy, crying. The crying is a symptom of his fear, of his being lost. She sees that. She feels it. She expresses sympathy, if not empathy. "This must be a Hebrew child." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a Hebrew nurse? I have somebody who can take the burden of raising this child off your shoulders. Please do that. I'd like to have somebody do it." And cleverly, she gets Moses' mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said, verse 8, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I'll pay wages." She now gets paid to raise her own child. Yeah, right. So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, who made him her son. She named him Moses, explaining, "I drew him out of water." These five women play pivotal, fundamental roles in the prologue to the great narrative of liberation. Now think about it for a second. This great narrative of liberation is already foreshadowed in miniature in the stories that we've read so far. The defeat of Pharaoh has already been foreshadowed by these five women who worked together in order to defeat his plan, not the last plan he has. Let's be realistic about it. He's not actually beaten. But he's defeated by Egyptian women, by Hebrew women, and by his own daughter in anticipation. These people already foreshadow liberation. In a patriarchal society, it's the women who get to the freedom before the men do in these stories. And I want to suggest to you that there are two elements of the what I'm calling revolutionary counter-narrative. It features the liberation of the oppressed class, women, who take decisive active roles. But also, in some of these stories, certainly the story of Tamar, a Canaanite, and the story of the Egyptian midwives and the Pharaoh, and soon we'll see, but our time is running out and maybe we won't, Ruth, it's also the counter-narrative which calls into question the adequacy of the idea of the chosen people. That God has selected one people and God is on this people's side and against the other peoples. The idea, a prevailing idea in the Torah, is what we might call a binary notion of us and them. And God is on us's side. God is on our side and not on their side. They deserve to be marginalized, at some points to be exterminated, at some points to be pushed aside. Some of these stories of women feature a double critique of the Bible's master narrative about the subordination of women and its inadequacy, and about the claim that God really cares fundamentally and maybe exclusively about us. And Ruth is another example. Ruth is a Moabite woman. The Torah says that the Moabites are arch enemies of the Israelites and should be kept out of the congregation of the Israelites up to, I can't remember, 10 generations. Ruth, we don't have time to look at it, is a Moabitess woman who calls into question the adequacy of that idea about the Moabites, as well as herself being, let's face it, a nobody. She's just some person that Naomi's son married while they were in exile in Moab, and she just happens to go back with Ruth. Let's just look very briefly at the second page of the Ruth story. I just want to read verse 22. You know the story of Ruth. Naomi says to her, them, go back. There's no future for you with me. Go back to your family. They say no. Naomi says, come on, there's no future. I know you're trying to do the right thing. Orpah, one of the wives, says, okay, I'll go back. Ruth says no. But Ruth, the root davkabab, but Ruth clung to Naomi. And they go back together. And when they get back in Bethlehem, verse 19, the women look at Naomi and they say, can this be Naomi? You know the word Naomi means pleasant. Is this the epitome of pleasantness? She says, verse 20, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. Call me bitter. For God has made my lot very bitter. This is already Job's outcry in the mouth of Naomi. I went away full. I had a husband and sons. And the Lord brought me back empty. I have nothing. How can you call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me? when Shaddai has brought misfortune upon me. Thus Naomi returned from the country of Moab. She returned with her daughter-in-law, Ruth the Moabite. But I have nothing. What she doesn't realize, and one of the great ironies of the story, is she has everything she needs. She has Ruth. And Ruth is going to save her line. And notice how this chapter ends. The book of Ruth began with there was a famine in the land. That's why they went to Moab. It ends, they arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Things are turning bright because the famine is over. But it's also over in another sense. It's over for Naomi and for her family. Go to the next page and let's just read the last couple of verses of the story of Ruth, who, as you know, does bear a child. The bracketed part. All the people at the gate and the elders answered, "We are," whatever that means. "May the Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah." Ruth, a Moabitess, a nobody, is now analogized with Rachel and Leah. "Both of whom built up the house of Israel. Prosper in Ephratah and perpetuate your name in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Peretz, whom Tamar bore to Judah." She's being analogized to Tamar, that great Canaanite heroine. "Through the offspring which the Lord will give you." So Boaz married Ruth, became his wife, and so on and so on. Verse 16, Naomi took the child held to her bosom. She became its foster mother. The women neighbors gave him a name, saying, "A son is born," named him Obed, the father of Jesse, the father of David. This is the line of Peretz. Peretz begot Chetzron, Chetzron Ram, Ram Aminadav, Aminadav Nachshon, Nachshon Salmon, Salmon Boaz, Boaz Obed, Obed Jesse, and Jesse begot David. Here's what was required to even get to David at all. You had to have Tamar and her great heroic action, because she's the father of Peretz. Without Peretz, there's no Boaz. You had to have Ruth, a Moabitess, from the very heart of the enemy. You also had to have, and I wanted to read this story, the story of Lot and his daughters. You remember back in chapter 19 that Lot and his daughters seemed to them to be the only people to have survived the debacle of Sodom and Gomorrah. So the daughters say to themselves, "This is the end." Well, what recourse do we have? We've got to have intercourse with our own father, because he's the only male and we're the only females. And from those acts of sexual intercourse come the Moabites and the Ammonites. This has two meanings to the Torah, it seems to me. One, this is a way of ridiculing the enemies of Israel, the Ammonites and the Moabites. Look at your yichus. Look at your background. But it's also a way of celebrating the miracle of David. Because without this act of courage on the part of Lot's daughters, without the act of courage of Tamar, the mother of Peretz, without the act of courage of Ruth, the Moabitess, there would have been no King David. There would have been no unification of the tribes. There would have been no founding of Jerusalem. There would have been no Book of Psalms. There would have been no Messiah. From where? From these remarkable women. Doesn't it seem plausible to you, it does to me, that the Bible is mounting a counter-narrative here, really two counter-narratives, about the integrity and resources that can come from outside the Israelites. And from this lower class of individuals, women, one must see this class of people as decisive. This is a challenge to the adequacy of patriarchy, to which the Bible is also committed. This is an idea, I think, of the combination of idealism and realism. The realism is you can't overturn the institutions and customs of society overnight. But you can mount aspirations and work toward their gradual realization. And that's what this counter-narrative purports to do. On the very last page, I quote from Lawrence Kushner's lovely book, God Was in This Place, and I Didn't Know It. Kushner writes, the first utterance, the first of the Ten Commandments, is only God's self-announcement. God, as it were, says, my card. Here's my card. There in the center is the name of God. Then beneath it in italics, frees slaves. And in fine print in the lower right-hand corner, call anytime. The great aspiration of biblical religion is to maximize the distribution of freedom. Society, of necessity, has to devise classes. And certain people have certain offices, certain people are leaders in some domains and certain are not. So that society of necessity cannot maximize freedom for all individuals. But it's an aspiration. And through this counter-narrative, what I'm calling a double counter-narrative, this fundamental aspiration of liberation is being realized both through the Bible's master narrative and through the narratives that call its adequacy into question. I've gone on a little too long. People who need to leave, of course, may. Thank you. Those who want to stay and ask some questions and have some discussion may, of course, too, get up at any time. I will keep talking to the last person as it's gone.
David Cerrone.
Oh, sure.
He and I went to Curtis. We lived in the same, I tell you, way leads to way. We lived in the same house.
Did you?
For 2 years.
Oh, not at Curtis? No, his wife, too, is a violinist.
Why is it, I don't know the wife, because when he lived there, he was undergrad, and I don't know her. He probably met her at Curtis.
Yeah, and him. He met her at Curtis, right. And I.